This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa. Taking care of business and working overtime. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And we'd like to welcome you to the Money Talk program, everybody. I am Don Soa here on AM 790, your home of talking business. Delighted to have you joining us during your drive time home. Please be careful out there. But if you are in a safe place, Brett, my producer here, likes me to remind you, this is a call-in talk show, and we will take your calls at 437-5000. That is the local number, 437-5000. If you are outside the immediate area, it's 888-345-0790. That is 888-345-0790. That's a toll-free number. Give him your question if you can't chat with me because it's not safe if you're out there driving, and he'll plug it right into my screen, and we will make sure we get to your topic during the course of your drive home. If you are a safe place, if you're at the office, at home, sitting in the driveway, whatever you can be, you have a reason to chat, you have a conversation that you think is important not only to you, but maybe even to some of our other listeners, please let Brett know that, and he'll make sure that I know that, and we will get you on as quickly as we can. We do, in fact, respect your time here on the Money Talk program. Stocks ended higher today. Traders assessed some news in the economic data category. Oil prices were also moving higher. That obviously helps some major companies out there in the global marketplace. Dow closed 69 points higher at the end of the day. Goldman Sachs and United Health contributed the most to those gains. The S&P 500 was up almost 0.3%. Financials outperforming the other sectors. Lifting the sector were bank stocks as the Spider S&P Bank ETF, KBE, and the regional bank ETF, KRE. They popped more than 2% on average. Now, the NASDAQ added about 0.28%, and that set a record high closing for the tech-heavy index. Now, energy stocks were also among the better performers today, with the sector rising about 0.7%. Crude oil rose 1.7% to settle at around $50.35 a barrel, building on Wednesday's gains after better-than-expected inventory information was issued. Now, although the relatively bullish U.S. crude inventories data and supply disruptions in Libya have provided some oil markets a welcome boost, the gains may be limited as investors mull over the effectiveness of OPEC's supply cuts. Clearly, the economic data was constructive today, and that continues to be the case overall, according to Art Hogan, who is with Wunderlich Securities. Here's their market strategist. The U.S. economy grew today. Well, it was announced that it was growing today at a rate of 2.1% in the final quarter of this past year. That was more than expected as they revised that information. Other data released Thursday included weekly jobless claims, which fell by 3,000, right around 258,000 jobs in the jobless claims numbers. Bottom line, this I know is old news as we are 2 days away from finishing the first quarter, but at least we see, you know, from the base that we're moving from, that things are looking better. That said, U.S. Treasuries gave up slight gains following the data's release, with the benchmark 10-year yield rising to 2.4%. Yields have pulled back from their 2017 highs since the Federal Reserve raised interest rates earlier this month, but maintained their outlook mostly unchanged. Now, intermediate yields are likely to move higher this year, but at a very, very gradual pace, according to most chief investment officers and analysts, like a guy like Chris Malumphy, who's with Templeton Fixed Income Group. His view is that the market might have gotten a bit exuberant maybe earlier in the year. Dallas Fed President Bob Kaplan and New York Fed President Bill Dudley are both due to speak during the course of the day today. We'll have to get some commentary from them and see what they're speaking about and what their opinions are about Fed policy moving forward. And remember, Fed policy is oftentimes used as a sort of a benchmark for what they think the economy is doing as the year goes on. Friday marks the last day of the first quarter. This is tomorrow. Entering today's session, the NASDAQ composite had actually gained 9.56% for the year, while the S&P and the Dow had risen about 5.46 and 4.54, respectively. These are pretty good numbers, folks, given that it's only a one quarter of the year. The NASDAQ obviously growing almost 10%. We better be warned, these are aberrations ultimately, maybe a little bit of a continuation of the speculation that has come out of the new the inauguration of a new president and the new dynamics that exist in Washington with the White House, the House of Representatives, and the Senate essentially in the control of the Republicans. When one party has that kind of dominance in Washington, there is at least some expectation. I'm not saying a guarantee, but at least some expectation that programs and policies that would typically be embraced by whichever party, whether it's the Democrats, whether it's the Republicans, or as you might say, whether it's the conservatives versus the liberals, you would expect those policies to be ones that would be embraced. And because all three houses are dominated by that one party, that there's at least a better than likely chance, although not guaranteed again, but better than likely, that some of those policies could in fact move forward. The Republican Party has been viewed historically, and I say it that way carefully, as the party the party of business, business sensitive. We now have a president who's viewed as a business savvy and business supportive president. So, you know, there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of hopefulness. And maybe these numbers you're looking at in terms of the markets year to date with the blue chip indices, the S&P and the Dow up between 4 and 5%. In the NASDAQ up in excess of 9, maybe that's reflective of the market saying, hey, we think that maybe there's at least a better than average opportunity here for growth-oriented policies and business-oriented policies to be embraced by in what we call fiscal policy. In the previous 8 years, we have seen very little in the way of fiscal stimulus. What we have seen is a lot of monetary policy stimulus in the forms of quantitative easing, quantitative QE1, QE2, and QE3, which is all driven by the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve had gotten to a point where they said we can no longer do this on our own. Coming off of the recession of 07 and 08, we saw markets struggling for some sort of footing, but ultimately got a period of recovery following the recession from 2009 through the present, where the economy was growing essentially right around 2% per year. Not bad, fairly steady, but kind of slowly churning its way higher, and the markets reflected that. And we've seen a decent period of the stock market, although not a straight line up, but certainly the averages over that 8-year period since 08 have been pretty impressive. Where in the last 2 days of this quarter, today and tomorrow, and most of the end of the quarter, window dressing has probably taken place already, according to Bob Cardillo. He's a chief market economist with First Standard Financial. He says that he believes that the market is going to stay sort of range-bound until maybe the beginning of the new quarter, and we get some sense, you know, in April, and we get some sense of what direction the market is going to go in this new quarter. The new quarter, what's also unique about it is it'll be the first full quarter with with full all 3 months under the administration, where the White House will, you know, under the Trump administration, will have all 3 months with which to push whatever policies are in their bucket list. And to see, more importantly, after their experience with the health care bill, you know, what areas of the economy, what areas of their own policy initiatives do they have the best chance of moving forward and making progress on? They certainly want to deal with tax reform. They certainly want to deal with reforming a lot of the regulations that exist out there in numerous sectors of the economy, including financial services. You know, that said, opening up the coffers and seeing if we can engage in some of the very, very much needed infrastructure spending in the country. Roads, bridges, tunnels, water systems, telecommunication, airports, you name it. We haven't spent a lot of money. There has not been a lot of great movement and innovation in areas of infrastructure. And if there can be a major commitment to infrastructure spending, that will not only create jobs, it'll create higher salary jobs, and it'll be one more part of under Keynesian style economics, one more part of a growing and dynamic economy. And we'll have to wait and see. If we can start to see that kind of movement, then you'll start seeing the stock market reflecting expectations for higher returns. I'm Don Sowa. You are listening to the Money Talk program here on AM 790. We are your home of talking business here in southern New England. Glad to be here with you during your drive time. I'll be right back. And we welcome you back to the second segment here of tonight's Money Talk program. I'm Don Sower, delighted to have you here with me. We're the longest-running financial talk program here in southern New England, and there's some debate out there. We're still going to get follow-up information. We are certainly one of the longest-running financial call-in talk shows in the country, starting our show back in January of 1991. This is our 26th year on the air, so I think we've got some bragging rights anywhere. And by the way, we don't get bragging rights if it wasn't for you. The show would not be on the air if you were not interested in learning more about money, especially as it affects you personally and some of the major decisions that you're going to have to make about your life. I think it's fascinating. Somebody was telling me that he actually started listening to the Money Talk program the very first week it came on the air back in January of 91. And he suggested to me that here he is today. He said he's now 66 years old and he just retired, but he started listening to the show when he was 40. He says he had just started a new job down in East Greenwich, and he's been there the whole time. And I asked him, I says, well, geez, I hope that some of the advice that we gave you over that time was useful. He says, oh, yeah, we used it a lot. I had my new company had a 401k plan. I'd never used one before. He says, you and your Get Back to Basics shows back then went a long way to explaining how those things worked and, you know, why we should use them. And I wasn't sure whether I was even going to bother. And I knew there were some people, because it was a new program, some people at work that had no interest in doing it at all. After listening to you on the air, he suggested that, you know, he started counseling his friends in his department, at least, at work to actually start using the 401k, and he actually encouraged them to listen to the show and learn more. So, hey, I'm glad that we were able to help. And I'm telling you, anybody that we can encourage on this program to start saving money in a disciplined, reasonable, and effective manner, especially if you have a good 401k plan or a good 403b, good types of programs that will actually provide you the opportunity to draw money out of your paycheck, make it out of sight, out of mind, make it as automatic as possible, and get you in a situation where you're giving your investment savings plan a raise every time you get a raise. Well, guess what? All of a sudden, 26 years later down the road, you know, you've got a sizable amount of money. You actually turned what seemed like small dollars as a commitment into what is real money, and the definition of real money is going to be unique to each person, I'm sure. But to me, and I'm sure to this guy whose name is Steve, he told me that he said, well, to me, it's what afforded me the ability here at age 66 with my Social Security and my wife's Social Security. We now have the ability to actually retire. And that was the big issue. Having the ability to make that choice means that you're successful. It means that you're wealthy. Because I think a wealthy person is a person who can dictate for themselves the financial choices they make in their lives and not have those choices dictated to them by other people or by their circumstances. And I think that's great. And I'm grateful for any small part that we can play in your life and encourage you to be a saver, to be an investor, and to do it thoughtfully, to do it intelligently. And we'll try to give you as much help as we can right here on this program. As I mentioned in the first segment of the show, if you do have a specific question, maybe about your own plan, maybe about if it's philosophical, in other words, about your attitude, or any big issue that comes up that affects your pocketbook, call us here. 437-5000 is the local number. 888-345-0790 is the toll-free number. Brett will be happy to help you out. And we do understand if you can't get on the line with us, you know, call anyway, give the question. Our producers here, especially Brett, always make sure that I get the question. So that's we're here to serve you, and we're grateful for that opportunity. Now, I mentioned in the first segment of the show that the market has had a good quarter, where we're about to come to the close tomorrow of the first quarter of 2017. It is the first quarter of a new presidential administration. And with that administration, it's the first quarter of the environment we're in, where you have the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the White House, the executive branch, all under the control, seemingly, of the same party. Now, the Republicans, the problem with having said that statement, there are some people who might assume that being part of the Republican Party means that all of the individual players are the same. And I think what we've learned, and certainly what our new president has learned, is that all Republicans do not, they don't order their food from the same menu, I guess is what I can suggest. Some of them are more socially liberal than others. Some of them are more fiscally conservative than others. There's a lot about attitude, and they're not all created equal. And I think John Boehner, the previous Speaker of the House, learned that when he found that he could not work with what was then called the Tea Party. the ultra-conservative wing of the Republican Party at the time. He didn't want to be part of something that was going to be an ineffective governing body. So he turned it over to somebody who was part of the Tea Party, and that gentleman is Paul Ryan, Congressman Paul Ryan. And now Ryan is discovering how difficult things can be because the largest number of representatives in the Congress are not members of the Tea Party, as it turns out. They are part of what we'd call the moderate wing of the Republican Party. But there's enough members in either side to really mess up what would be considered the majority type of efforts. And I think that's the lesson that our president has learned. He says that the Republicans are not all created equal, and he discovered that he cannot depend on them all marching in line with the plans and the bucket list that he's presented to America. The fact that he has made promises, the president, to the American people, promises that may have in many ways gotten him elected. He thought that he could come to the Congress and actually point out to them, okay, these are the promises that we have made. We have to stick to them. So here's how we need to vote. And he's discovered that some of these folks, despite promises, are very, very stubborn. And maybe they view their view of the promises are different. Well, anyway, as I mentioned, the month of March of the 3 months has been a little bit mixed. The blue chip indices, the S&P and the Dow, up between 4% and 5% for the quarter so far. Pretty good 3 month period. But March itself has been bumpy, and it's probably been bumpy as investors gut. I guess digested the reality that the Republicans, the Republican-led bill that was supposed to potentially repeal and replace Obamacare, that bill was defeated, or should we say it never actually got put out to a vote. Speaker Ryan discovered he did not have the votes. 17-day effort, not really a meaningful effort, I suppose, by any reasonable historic standard. But after 17 days of this, the president said, okay, he's had enough of it. He's done. And he wants to move on to other things. Now he's going to learn about what we call political linkage and the fact that it was the expectation of some levels of success with repeal and replace on the Affordable Care Act that would have freed up tax revenue. That freed up tax revenue is what was going to be necessary to sell the president's policies and programs related to tax reform. Both very, very important, both, of course, promises not only the president made, but that a great many Republicans made to their constituencies, saying we will come in here and we will reform the tax code. We will make it much more efficient. We will do things that will help stimulate growth. All good ideas, but everything has to get paid for. And there was revenue that should have been coming from a reform of the healthcare system. That revenue is not going to be there until they come up with some sort of a reasonable health care program, a program that frees up some tax revenue that was spent on the Affordable Care Act to make it work. If you get rid of the Affordable Care Act, then maybe some of that revenue is available to help fund tax reform, which they want to see as revenue neutral. And so there's your big debate. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ for the month of March, as a result of the failure of the Republican-led bill, to replace Obamacare. The end result was the NASDAQ was up 0.26% for the quarter. The S&P was. The NASDAQ was up 1.26% for the month of March. And the Dow Jones, a slight loss, believe it or not. The 30 companies that make up the Dow were down a bit. Healthcare getting shelled is not the end of the world, and we can move forward possibly with tax reform, according to Art Hogan. I mentioned his name earlier. He's with Wunderlich Securities. He's an analyst on Wall Street. I've been quoting him for decades, I think. Now he's been around forever. If there is no new drama out of Washington, D.C., Hogan is saying the stock market should ultimately do fine. It won't go up in a straight line, but it probably will overall, on average, go up here in the second quarter. About 8 stocks advanced for every 5 that declined. And the trade volume overall was about 1.3 billion shares trading on the composite. The volatility index, which tells you how much fear there is potentially in the market, was around 11.3, a very, very low number. So I'm not surprised that the market had a pretty good day. Folks, it's halftime here on the Money Talk program. I'm Don Sola. We're going to be back and we're going to talk about bonds, the fact that they are not all created equal, and things you need to know in a rising interest rate environment if you're going to be a bond investor. I'll be right back. And And we welcome you to the second half of tonight's program here on AM 790. This is Money Talk. I'm Certified Financial Planner Professional Donald Sowa. Glad to have you here with me tonight. Tune in tomorrow at 5 o'clock, by the way. Steve Beauvais will be here, my colleague. And we'll be closing out the week, and we'll be closing out the month, and we'll be closing out the first quarter of 2017 with Steve's commentary as he closes out the week. A strengthening economy, which is, of course, what we hope for. A great many of the policies of the incoming administration, in order to get a great many of their bucket list items accomplished, not only require moving money around within the current spending structure, the current budget structure, taking money that is maybe wastefully used or inappropriately used, or at least if that's what the administration believes, not getting the full bang for their buck, getting rid of wasteful or inappropriate programs, taking the savings from those reforms and moving that into areas that they believe will be more fruitful. But a great deal of what President Trump would like to do, and certainly that the House and Senate would like to do, are going to depend upon a growing economy. So that's another side of this. And the problem with depending upon economic growth to justify or provide support to major programs, major initiatives, administrative initiatives, is that it takes time. So the investments you make today, the changes you make in policy, the money that you move around may prove to be very fruitful, may prove to be exactly what you need, but sometimes it could take, well, it can even take years before you see the true fruits of that labor. So if you have an economy that's growing faster than the 1.5 to 2% we've seen in the last several years, that means that there's going to be more revenue generated within the economy. It means that there's going to be more tax revenue provided and available to both state and federal governments. And that available capital can then be used for other programs, some of which will promote jobs and growth themselves. But a strengthening economy typically means, yes, more jobs. Yes, there's also going to be some adjustments to the inflation rate. Things will start to cost more as the economy grows. Companies, the good news is, will be able to, perhaps after a stagnant period, be able to increase the cost of their products, their goods and services. Many companies haven't been able to make adjustments to their pricing in a very long time. And if that doesn't happen, unless their business product demand or service demand grows dramatically, then they're not going to be able to give their employees raises, and they're probably not going to be able to add new jobs to the existing company, or expand the company as it is, or change the nature of the company as it would be warranted. So anyway, when you start to see this change and you start to see the adjustments in inflation is part of that economic growth, it also opens the door to something else. And that's the fact that the financial side of inflation, monetary inflation, interest rates rise. So we were following about 0.25% rate hike in December of last year from the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve recently announced another rate increase, about another 0.25%. Now, that moves the key borrowing rate to a roughly 0.75 to 1% range. That's significant, perhaps, for investors who have sizable bond holdings. But rising interest rates generally correlate to a drop in bond prices. So when interest yields, when the rates are rising, the value of the underlying bonds typically go down. We call that a reciprocal or inverse relationship. Now, while the recent quarter point increase probably won't have a drastic effect on the returns of your current bond holdings, perhaps future rate hikes could prove to have more impact on you. All I'm trying to do here, by the way, I'm not trying to scare you. I personally am a bond investor. I invest for the benefit of my clients, and I certainly recommend it here on the Money Talk program to you as part of your portfolio. Now, what kind of bonds you have, how much of your portfolio is invested in those bonds, that's going to be solely dependent upon who you are, what your time frame is, what your goals are. Please, please, please talk to your financial advisor about this. Hey, let's face it, we're at the beginning of a brand new year. If you haven't already, you should be sitting down, having an annual review, taking a look at how things went last year. Hey, listen, you got questions about the incoming administration and what this will mean to the economy, what that will mean to your investments? Fine. This is a great time to have that conversation. It's not too late, even though we're here near the end of the month of March. So looking at these issues and saying, okay, am I properly allocated? Do I own the things that will not be hurt by what would be thought of as reasonable expectations of a new administration in Washington? Again, you're speculating a little bit. I get it. I know it. But your advisor should have his or her ear to the ground, getting a better sense of where the risks are in this economy and in its market, and at least trying to devise a portfolio for you based upon who you are. As long as you know that that's the issue, then the issue of market timing doesn't become an issue. You shouldn't be market timing to begin with, especially with critically important dollars like retirement money. Now, we do have an expectation of additional rate increases on bonds. Now, there are some potentially costly mistakes, things that you can avoid, when you're managing your bond-related investments. Now, bonds aren't all the same. They're not all created equal, and it's important that you keep in mind that reality as rates rise. Now, one of the most common mistakes that bond investors need to avoid is assuming that all bonds are going to react the same way, assuming that they're all going to react negatively to higher rates. That doesn't always happen. Chief investment strategist over at People's United Wealth Management is a young lady named Carissa McDonough. And she was interviewed recently, and she said that there are very different segments of the bond market in a variety of ways to position in a rising interest rate environment. Again, all bonds don't respond the same. McDonough says, making blanket assumptions about bonds when interest rates are on the move, that may lead some investors to exit the asset class that they're in prematurely. In other words, even though the bond market is changing, you may be still in the right place. Change may not be necessary or even appropriate. Now, in doing so, you're discounting the important role that bonds play when it comes to smoothing out the overall investment portfolio volatility that you have. There are reasons to own bonds in your portfolio, folks, reasons other than getting current income. The truth is, bonds as a sector, as an asset allocation sector, as an area of allocation, tend to respond differently to changes in market condition. They respond differently than stocks typically do. They're not as correlated to the market as stocks may be. So if you're in an environment that is not good for stocks, maybe your bonds are doing relatively well. Or if stocks are doing poorly, perhaps owning some bonds in your portfolio means that some part of your money, your portfolio, will not perform as badly as that money that is in stocks. Now, in saying this, I'm not predicting that the market's going to perform badly. I'm suggesting to you, though, a well-designed portfolio, if you're properly allocated, it almost assures you that some part of your portfolio is not going to be doing as well as you would like it to at any given moment. But today's top performing asset here at the end of March may well not be the top performing asset at the end of June, but today's poor performer may be the top performer at the end of June. It's a little like a Ferris wheel. There's going to be people in the cart at the bottom of the Ferris wheel while there are people at 12 o'clock at the top of the Ferris wheel, right? And it's going around and around, so you're constantly going to be changing your position. So the fact that you'd maybe want to be up at the top of the Ferris wheel where you get that nice breeze and that really cool view of the carnival, yeah, everybody wants to be in that upper half of the Ferris wheel. But to be up there at some point, you had to be in the bottom half, and it's going to go around and around. And that's a much better analogy for a properly allocated portfolio, in my opinion, than perhaps a roller coaster. We hear that one too. Larry Kalavig, he's with Minnesota-based Haven Financial Group. He says that investors also need to understand the differences between various bond types as they add new bonds to their portfolios. They don't all behave the same way. Too often, investors purchase what we call low-rated bonds, as well as bonds with long maturity dates, because they want to get a higher dividend yield. They're searching for yield. And that result can be expensive. It can be devastating. Many investors, according to Kalavig, are better served by purchasing highly rated bonds, you know, at the issue, at the point of issue, at the time they come out, and holding them to maturity. One thing that that does for you is, based upon the credit quality of the underlying company, is that guarantees, based on the company's credit quality, that when you get to maturity, say it's a 10-year bond, Well, in the 10th year, you will get your money back. Your initial principal, let's say it was $10,000, will be returned to you. And the quarterly dividend you receive, well, that's like rental income. In other words, you made a $10,000 loan to that company, and they're going to pay you rent while they're using your money. And the deal, the promise is they'll pay that rent quarterly, and at the end of the period, maybe 10 years possibly, and that last month goes by, you will get your $10,000 back. So it's a return of principal and a stable ongoing dividend. And they told you what the dividend would be right up front. Many times that dividend is going to be based upon the credit quality of the company. So if you're going to take more risk, perhaps with a smaller issuer, smaller company, yeah, they're going to pay out a much higher dividend yield than perhaps General Electric or Coca-Cola or Johnson & Johnson. These are monstrously big companies that are in a far better, safer fiscal position. Their ability to pay back your principal at maturity is far greater. So it's a safer bond issue. It's a higher credit quality. If you go with a smaller company, even a very, very well-managed, fiscally sound smaller company, they're going to have to pay you a higher dividend to get you to give them your money versus one of the bigger blue-chip companies. Does that make sense? Well, that's part of that issue. A lot of people stretch for a higher yield, and the end result is they're getting a lower credit quality company that does, in fact, run a slightly higher risk of potential default. If you're willing to do that, maybe you get a higher dividend. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the duration of bonds. I'm Don Sowa. This is the Money Talk program. We'll be right back, so please stick around. And we're back with the Money Talk program. Now, when we discuss bonds, remember, there's a distinction and a difference between buying an individual bond or a portfolio of individual bonds or buying a mutual fund that purchases a basket of bonds for you. If you buy a mutual fund, except in the case of a fund index or an ETF, you are getting the benefit of a team of individuals who are doing the research on the credit quality of the underlying bonds, the possibility, the blending of the yields on them in order to achieve certain specific goals. A mutual fund is not going to have to deal with the issue of specific maturities, even though the longer you own the bond fund, the yield, the dividend yield can change as the maturities of the holdings internally. In other words, you got a basket of bonds, and those bonds inside that basket are themselves going to come to maturity on occasion. Now, if you have enough money invested that you could sit down with a manager or a portfolio manager who could select your own basket of bonds, then you have to pay attention to them. When interest rates rise, it's very important to understand how long you're locked in to a particular bond's investment. An investor needs to be careful not to extend too far out into maturity or the duration of the bond itself. Now, the most critical mistake investors should avoid when it comes to bonds is a rising rate environment, and you got to avoid being overweight in what we call longer-term fixed income investments. When interest rates are starting to rise, the longer maturities, the 15, the 20, the 25, the 30-year bonds, some of them have very long maturities, the impact on the value of that bond as the interest rates rise is going to become greater on you, the investor, especially if you're looking at the present value of your investment plan. In other words, your statement that you get each month from the company, you may see a dramatic change in there in those particular bonds that have long maturities. So understanding duration does, in fact, matter. Some investment advisors believe that it's especially true when investors are utilizing mutual funds, since they'll be hit with a double whammy. I mentioned this a moment ago, when rates actually start to rise. Generally, the longer the duration of a bond, the more risk you're exposed to as the rates increase. Understanding the duration, I think if you're in, like, say, bonds, there are some short to intermediate term bond funds. There are some that have maturities in the 1 to 3 year average within the basket in the fund. There's some that have the intermediate ranges, usually 2 to 7 years right now. Those funds may not pay out as high a dividend yield, but they're going to also be carrying less risk to the bond value when interest rates are rising. So understanding the duration of individual bonds within your portfolio is very important for qualifying and quantifying your value of interest rate sensitivity. Now, these rates matter from day to day. The reason it matters, not just in a mutual fund, but also in an individual fund, is if you're buying a 10-year bond and you're 5 years into its ownership, you've owned it for 5 years, I mean, you know that if you hold it to maturity in 10 years, you're going to get your whole $10,000 back. But I've seen occasions where interest rates were rising, where halfway into the maturity period, which is 5 years, the value of the underlying bond had dropped to about $7,000. You invested 10 originally, and if you were to sell after 5 years, in other words, liquidate the bond in the open market, in other words, call your advisor, say, hey, I need to liquidate the bond, I need the cash, the valuation on your statement doesn't say $10,000. That was the original maturity, and it may be the final maturity if you hold it, but if you sell it in the fifth year, it could come out valued at $7,000. Now, that would occur when? When interest rates are rising. Now, as interest rates change, those longer duration bonds, longer maturities, should exhibit larger price swings compared to those of the shorter durations. Now, if investors believe that rates will rise aggressively and for a prolonged time period, in other words, we're moving into a period where rates are simply going to be rising, remember, that's not totally unusual or totally unforeseen, given that we've been in a bond bull market where interest rates have been dropping for the last 30 years. And if interest rates have been dropping during that time from high double digits down to where we are now, that's during that same period, the underlying bond market has been rising in value. Underlying bonds rising as the interest rate yields come down. You may want, if you have these prolonged time period issues, you may want to consider exchanging longer duration bonds for some of the shorter ones, if you can. Now, some advisors say that investors need to be careful to avoid looking at their individual bond durations in a vacuum, pointing to the Fed's recent rate hike announcement. The Fed is raising short-term rates, but not long-term rates. The long-term rates don't necessarily have to follow the short-term rates, in other words. Higher rates don't always cause a parallel upward shift in Treasury yield curves. So, while it's important to be aware of the duration of individual bonds, investors also have to look at the entire portfolio you own in a variety of potential interest rate outcomes. In other words, you don't want to have all of your eggs in one basket, even on the bond side, and you might have laddered your securities with different maturities over time, with different interest rates. Another mistake some investors in the bond market can't afford is losing sight of your bond's fit within your larger investment strategy. Investors need to have complete clarity as to the role of the bonds in your portfolio. Why are they there? Are they there for current income? Probably not in most cases, or at least most of the time. Oftentimes, they're there to stabilize the volatility of your overall portfolio. The bonds are typically less volatile, less risky than your stock holdings. Analyst Donaldson says that the role is determined by risk tolerance and your need for cash. That's when they talk about your time frame. When are you going to need the money? See, it's not about how old you are as you get closer to retirement. It's even though you're getting older, typically. It's because as you get closer to retirement, you're closer to a time frame where you may need to translate these investments into cash to support your lifestyle. Investors' individual timeline matters. Now, that timeline, according to Donaldson, should account for not only retirement, but other major financial events, such as putting your kids through school, buying a second home, any number of major financial targets that you would accumulate money for. Matt Eastman, who is a managing partner with Cornerstone Financial Services, says, it's vital for investors to understand how their bond investments fulfill a specific criteria to meet your investment goals. That's the fundamental reasoning behind having a diversified portfolio. This is especially important with bonds because we're dealing with both the market value of the bond as well as the yield provided to the investor. McDonough says that it's key for investors to understand what bonds do and do well. Bonds protect principal and generate income when necessary. The upside is receiving your principal back at maturity if you're able to hold it to maturity, plus the coupons you're contractually owed. You're getting paid rent on the money, and then you're getting your money back at maturity. That's the deal. Now, the potential downside, as I mentioned, is default. Of course, if the company that issued the bond goes belly up and can't honor the return on the money. We saw that with Greece. Greece is an issuer. and they were offering extraordinary dividend yields on you buying Greek bonds. The problem is they might have been a 5 or 10 year Greek bond. The problem was the chance of Greece defaulting on their bonds was pretty darn high. So I don't think I'd want to buy them. Loss of principal matters. And mitigated by some degree of potential recovery is always fine. Rising rates also offer investors an opportunity to purchase bonds at lower prices, but some research is necessary before you commit to an investment. The first thing to consider is where we are in the economic cycle, and from there, build some tactical over and underweights in the various sectors of the fixed income market. Other analysts emphasize the importance of understanding the credit quality and the rate profile of any security that's being purchased. A 5% coupon on a long muni bond may sound attractive, but the significant premium you're paying to buy it, given that rates are not that high, that premium being paid can undermine some of the yield considerations. So understand bonds. This is not for the faint of heart. I genuinely say find a financial advisor, but not any advisor, one who's an expert in the fixed income marketplace. Hey, I'm Don Sowa. Thanks for tuning into Money Talk. Again, tomorrow at 5, Steve Bovee will be with you. Have a good night.